to start this thing?
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
I like it.
And who are you?
Well, I'm Ross Chambliss.
And we're doing this together.
We are. We are together. We're united.
Finally. Ross, in every single episode, I think you were not in the first episode, but
right.
In every other episode of The Source, reporting on water issues, being my man on the ground in Salt Lake City, when I was staring down at 12 hours of water programming, at first I thought, oh, this is going to be no problem. Water is sort of endless. There's a sort of bottomless supply of stories. But then every month, I would think, how can we talk for an entire hour about water?
Right.
So I started to sort of feel the effects of the drought a little bit. I was like, maybe there isn't as much water stories out there as I thought there were. And, you know, I loved having another voice and bringing you in and knowing that we could, you know, at least between the two of us, with some help from a couple other people, try to tell the stories that were out there. And every month it happened, every month, I would come up with something. Usually I would either have a story in mind that I wanted to build around, or I would just pick the topic and say, I bet we can find 4 stories about drought this month, or I bet we can find stories about this. And I think that's how I would sort of approach you. Would be like, hey, here's the topic.
Yeah.
What do you got?
Yeah. Drought. Go out and find it.
Yeah, go.
Go tell something about it. Yeah, and I'll just say one more thing for me, I guess professionally, because, you know, I'm my real job or my day job is I'm a producer at KCBW in Salt Lake City. And being a producer means that 90-95% of the time, your voice really isn't out there. You know, I'm actually making other people sound good. I'm kind of pulling the strings and sitting behind the computer most every day. And this opportunity gave me a chance to go out into the field and record some tape and actually to use my own voice to tell some of these stories.
We got to go out in the field, which is really great. I mean, sometimes we did a couple of studio interviews and some phone interviews, but we got out there. I mean, Ross got to go out on the railroad causeway in the middle of the Great Salt Lake, which I was super jealous about that one, too.
And which is private property, so it was a little sketchy, but he didn't get arrested.
Ross also got to ride on the Marsh Master, a Phragmites destroying machine in the wetlands of the Great Salt Lake. He got to wear waders and hike up a stream to a massive beaver dam complex. But he also covered a lot of policy and legal issues that, frankly, I didn't want to get into. In May, Ross examined a particularly contentious legal battle on the show that was between private property owners and recreationalists who want access to public rivers and streams. We have an update on that story. I'll let Ross take it from here.
Back in early May, I spoke with Chris Olson. He leads the Utah Stream Access Coalition. We spoke about the 2010 Public Waters Access Act, or HB 141. This was the state law that took away access to any rivers flowing across private property, an estimated 2,700 miles of Utah's rivers and streams. The bill was introduced very abruptly at the end of the 2010 legislative session, with very little chance for public comment, and it was passed and signed by the governor. Ever since then, Olson's group has been battling to have that law overturned. And the last time we spoke, it was just after you guys had a victory. And I understand that you had kind of two legal options for overturning it. One was sort of questioning the navigability case of the law, and the other was sort of the constitutionality of the case. And when the last time we spoke, you guys had just won this navigability case. But it was only for a small section of the Weber River, right? So at that time, the 2010 Waters Act was still really the law of the land.
It still was. So that happened in May when we were last here. And what Judge Kelly ruled in that case was that a one-mile stretch, and actually a very disjoint one-mile stretch on the upper Weber, was navigable. And so what that means is that the title to those lands, based on the legal argumentation that happened, at time of statehood, that title should have been transferred to the state, and because this river was useful for the benefit of the people. Hmm. That case now has been appealed to the Utah Supreme Court. And we're, you know, we're waiting to hear from them. I think we're actually right in the midst of filing briefs on that right now to go through navigability.
And so that was the Weber River case.
That's correct.
And okay, and then you had your second case, which dealt more with the Provo River and the overall constitutionality of the case. And that decision happened around early November, right? Can you say what happened?
Yeah, so after we got done with the Weber case, in September we had five or six days of trial, I believe, with Judge Pullen in a different district court. And this was a case that we filed on the Provo River. And it basically, as you mentioned, it was to challenge the constitutionality of this House Bill 141 of the Public Waters Access Act. We, the argument that we had there was that, you know, when you when the legislature goes and regulates a resource, this, you know, that's the job of the legislature to do that. But when they do that, if they don't do it for the benefit of the people, then they're acting outside of what's called the public trust. And that was our argument, is that the legislature exceeded their bounds and went too far. And by giving away 43% of the public's resource, you know, they were in violation of the public trust doctrine. And Judge Pullen and the district court agreed with us.
Okay. Yeah, so this constitutionality case dealing with the Provo River was really sort of examining what had been lost or to some degree, you know, all of this public land or this public resource of our rivers and streams had basically been privatized, sort of trying to estimate what the loss, the damage was.
Right? Yeah, it was twofold. Well, there was many rounds. This went through the courts for 5 years before we finally got this this final judgment. But what Judge Pullen was asking at the very end was, well, what? First of all, what was lost, and second, what is the impact on what remains? And I think he very astutely pointed out in his ruling that, you know, if X, Y, and Z State Park are taken away, the fact that you can go recreate in these other lands is of little consequence because the scope of what was taken was so great. So by taking away 43% of the rivers and streams of the state, it's basically impossible for there to not be an impact on what's left.
Since Judge Pullen's decision, the case is on appeal to the Utah Supreme Court. In fact, both of their cases are on appeal. They expect to return to the court in the next couple years to challenge those appeals to preserve the stream access that they've gained. For the time being, the Stream Access Coalition has cautioned their members, who include anglers and other folks out recreating on streams adjacent to private property. Why is it important to be careful now?
In Judge Pullen's ruling, it returns us back to what was the Knatzer decision back in 2008. And while the Knatzer court said, yes, the public does have a right to touch the riverbeds while recreating in their resource, it didn't give a limit on what that easement was. It didn't define, all right, is this all the way up to the ordinary high water mark where the river rocks turn into grasses and you end up getting woody vegetation and that sort of thing. So we're cautioning people because we don't want people to exceed the limit of the easement. We don't want people to exceed the ordinary high water mark. We don't want people to get in a situation where they are, you know, trespassing and really trying to diffuse any of these conflicts. So, you know, we can show that just like in Idaho and Montana and some of these other states, landowners and anglers and recreators can get along just fine together.
And another quick follow-up to a story that Jennifer reported back in October, the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources STD of the Sea campaign.
Always practice safe boating. Don't infect Utah's lakes and streams with a skiff-transmitted disease. Invasive mussels start out as microscopic villagers.
The STD implicated in these ads is actually a family of freshwater mussels, zebra and quagga mussels, that have found their way into Utah's lakes where they reproduce rapidly and cause a lot of problems.
One of the DWR's other education campaigns to warn us about those invasive quagga mussels is just underway.
Welcome to the first annual Quagga Bowl at Lake Powell, where the aggressive spread offense of the quagga mussels will line up against the defenses from Brigham Young University, the University of Utah, and Utah State University.
This competition of sorts kicked off back in September. Basically, the division took 3 football helmets from the state's 3 biggest universities and submerged them in an undisclosed location in Lake Powell, where there's a known quagga mussel outbreak. The mussels like to cluster on hard surfaces below the water, and the helmet for the team that can hold off the most quagga mussels wins the game.
Really, it's designed to ultimately show how quickly quagga mussels can spread within lakes and reservoirs, given the opportunity.
This is Nathan Schwabach. He's the communications director for the Utah Department of Natural Resources.
So there are confirmed quagga mussels in Lake Powell. It's an invasive species that originated in Europe and has the eastern United States has been dealing with it for quite some time. It eventually made its way to Lake Mead and then to Lake Powell. Deer Creek is considered a suspect water at this point in time, and what that means is that at one point in time there was a sample taken in the water that showed a juvenile quagga mussel, and so that puts it in a state where we need to do consistent testing for several years, ongoing testing to determine if quagga mussels are in fact in that body of water or if that was perhaps a dead quagga mussel that was transported somehow. It never began to populate.
I see. So the concern is that really about containing this to where it is right now in Lake Powell, it could cost the state millions of dollars and cause all sorts of pollution in the waterways, et cetera, if this were to spread.
Absolutely.
Right?
Quagga mussels, given the opportunity, will destroy ecosystems. They impact recreation. For example, you could have quagga mussel shells lining lake shores and impacting recreation that way. And then given the opportunity, they can also clog and damage water infrastructure, so which could lead to millions of dollars in ongoing maintenance to keep those infrastructures performing accordingly.
So last year's football season came and went, but the division recently decided to extend the Quagga Bowl until next season.
We have a great, solid foundation of quagga mussels on all 3 helmets. We've decided to leave them in up until the start of next football season, and by that time you're going to see the tremendous impact that quagga mussel can have, given the opportunity to attach itself to something.
Okay, and so and how we're sort of scoring this competition is not by the higher the number of mussels is the winner, but rather the fewer the number of attached mussels is actually the winner. Is that correct?
It will actually be weight-based, and it will be the least amount or the least amount of weight will win. If there's no official prize to this, but we are tracking it.
Okay. And I guess there might be some of our listeners who might wonder if there's any sort of science being tested behind the use of these helmets, perhaps if the mussels might be attracted to any particular color or the way they're placed down there or, something like that.
Yeah, we joked about that, and actually I asked that question to our biologists and our invasive species experts. No, we don't anticipate any of this data being skewed by color or anything like that. Personally, my hope was they'd be more attracted to red than they would be to the blue, but that's not the case.
We'll have more updates and reminiscences from the past year when the source continues after a short break.